The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan
on News Talk.
Right now, though, joining me is Tánaiste Leo Varadkar. Tánaiste, you're very welcome to the show. So, listen, the Dáil breaking up for the summer recess tomorrow. Of course, we've just survived this motion of no confidence. In the wake of something like that, I mean, what is the sense? Is it kind of frustration that you had to go through it, or just simply relief that you've survived to fight another day?
Yeah, well, as you say, the Dáil goes into recess tomorrow, but work of government continues. Cabinet will continue to meet throughout July, and government departments will remain open, and constituency offices will be open, perhaps with the exception of a week or two in August. But, you know, we more than survived it. We demonstrated that we had a clear working majority in the Dáil. And if Sinn Féin hadn't refused Bernard Durkin a pair, he's sick with COVID at the moment, we would have won it by 20 votes. You know, so that's a really substantial margin. Overall majority governments often don't win confident votes by that margin. So I think it backfired on Sinn Féin. I think they wanted us to go into the summer break, you know, spinning this narrative that the government only had a working majority of two or three and it was only a matter of time before the government fell and, you know, Mary Lou would be Taoiseach and all that. That's not the case. This government has a solid working majority. We'll get the budget through in September. And the government will last full term, in my view. I see no reason why it shouldn't last full term. And that means there will not be a Sinn Féin-led government this year, next year, the year after, and maybe not even the year after that.
Did you have to do deals with some independent TDs to get them to vote with government? Like Matt Shanahan in Waterford, for example, it's going to be 24/7 cardiac care, is there?
Well, Matt Shanahan actually abstained, so that wasn't a vote with us, but it wasn't a vote.
But he was potentially going to vote against you.
Yeah, there were no formal deals done with independents that I was party to anyway. But what we would have done this consistently in this government and in the previous government is we would speak to independents who are willing to support the government, who are willing to support our us in confidence votes and vote with us on legislation most of the time, maybe not all of the time, and listen to their constituency concerns and see if we can help with them. But we would be doing that in exactly the same way for our own Oireachtas members and TDs and senators. So, you know, when it comes to issues in Waterford, you can be sure that I'm talking every other day to Senator Cummins about the North Keys and about the Waterford Crystal site for the TU in the South East, and also about the need to staff that second CAT lab. And that's the key thing that Deputy Shannon and Senator Cummins and Minister Butler are concerned about, that when that second CAT lab is completed and it's under construction now, that we can get it staffed and we can have extended hours for the CAT lab service there. I'm not sure it'll be 24/7, but it'll certainly be longer hours than is currently the case.
Would you accept, despite that strong showing from government last night in terms of the vote results, would you accept the reality that by definition you are in a more precarious position without Nessa Harrigan, Patrick Costello and Joe McHugh formally within the fold?
That's a statement of fact, but it's not a precarious position. You know, we demonstrated yesterday the day that we have a very clear working majority. And I think, although I wouldn't speak for them because it would be inappropriate to do so, I think the fact that the two Greens who don't currently have the whip voted with the government on this vote, and indeed haven't voted against the government on anything since the one vote they did vote against the government on, which was on the National Maternity Hospital, I think the indications are there that they may well be coming back into the Green Party formally, into the Green Party, parliamentary party formally, I should say. They're members of the Green Party, you know, later on this year, and I hope that does happen. And that actually means the government has restored that official majority, if you like, being over 81. But like I say, in practical terms, we have a very solid majority to get our programme done and to do the business of working for the Irish people, whether it's on the cost of living or dealing with Ukraine or housing or Brexit or all the things that we're responsible for.
What legislation then do you hope to get over the line or progress before the Dáil rises for the summer tomorrow?
Well, there's a load of it, actually. In the past 2 years, we've got 100 pieces of legislation through. I think that might be a record. Government's average around 40 a year. We're hitting about 50 a year. And a lot is going through this week at the moment. So, you know, one of the ones that's really important is abolishing hospital charges for children. That will help families with the cost of living, but also it's part of Sláinte Care and universal health care. Mr. Madigan is bringing through legislation on special needs so that we can speed up the process by which special classes are established for kids that need them. And that's really important in the Dublin area in particular. And I have two pieces of legislation that we'll get through this week. One is the law to protect people's tips, particularly people who work in the hospitality sector, making sure that if they get a tip or if there's a mandatory service charge, that that money goes to them and not to anyone else. And also we'll have the legislation through probably tomorrow on sick pay, and they then go off to the president for consideration and signature. And as well, we'll ratify the Treaty on Outer Space, which is may seem like a small thing.
Yeah, can you explain this one to me now? What is the Treaty on Outer Space, and why are we ratifying it?
Yeah, so this goes back to the 1960s to one of my predecessors, Minister George Colley, and at that time, Ireland signed the Outer Space Treaty, and it says that the moon and other celestial bodies, to use the term in the treaty, can only be used for peaceful purposes, and that space exploration is open to any country. And believe it or not, there are 80 or 90 Irish companies now involved with the European Space Agency. You know, whether it's involved in the IT or parts for satellites, you name it, we're very much involved in it now. But what's happening in the next few months is we're actually going to launch the first ever Irish satellite called AirSat, and that's being run out of UCD. Met the team there yesterday. So it's an exciting time. But before we launch the satellite, we have to make sure we have all the legals in place, and there's all these rules around who's liable if my satellite damages your satellite, and all that kind of stuff. So we've ratified that treaty now, which is important. Even though it seems like an almost comical thing, it's actually very serious. Mm. This is a big industry and one that we're going to get more involved in as a country.
Can I ask then just about what other plans the government may or may not be putting in place at the moment in terms of the cost of living crisis and how it might get worse? And specifically what I'm talking about is less so budgetary decisions and more contingency plans for gas hikes coming. So on the show yesterday, we were talking about the scheduled maintenance works that's happening on Nord Stream 1, which, as you know, pipes gas from Russia into Central Europe. Germany's hugely reliant on it. And the fears in Germany that actually the supply might not be turned on to the same degree on the other side of these scheduled works. And they are putting in place plans for that eventuality. Now, indirectly, that would impact us because some of their plans include going off and buying gas on other international markets, the same international markets that, you know, Britain buys gas on. Anyway, you understand the domino effect that this would have. If the Germans are putting in place those types of contingency plans, we are too, I take it.
The short answer is yes, and we have an energy supply working group that has a plan already for different scenarios, and we'll continue to update those plans over the summer. I should say there is a difference between the problems that we face when it comes to the cost of energy, and that's a huge issue I know now for families and for businesses, and the supply of energy. You know, there are different problems. One problem is it being very expensive. The other problem is it not being available at all, no matter how much money you have. So that second problem of supply has not yet arisen. But President Putin is willing to use commodities as a weapon of war. That's pretty clear now. Whether it's refusing to allow food and grain to get out of Ukraine to feed people in the developing world. And you see what's happening around the world in that regard, where it's causing upheaval and causing famine. And what he may do is cut off supply of gas to Europe in order to try to shut down industry in Europe as part of the war he's waging to expand Russia, essentially. We're slightly insulated from that in that we don't get much gas from Russia. It mainly comes either from our own gas field off County Mayo or predominantly from the UK and from there, from Norway and Qatar. But you're right to say there is a domino effect. So we have to plan for the possibility of reduced gas supplies.
How real is that possibility? Like, what's the operating theory?
It depends on, that actually depends on A, what happens in the Kremlin, whether President Putin decides to do this. And then secondly, how much gas we can get in from other parts of the world, whether it's the Middle East or Africa or the Eastern Mediterranean or North America and South America. There are other sources of gas in the world, but there is a possibility, and it is a real possibility, that we wouldn't be able, we wouldn't have enough gas to meet all our needs.
And what happens in that case? I know, because I know, again, because we were covering it yesterday in Germany, it's big heavy industry is the first to be told to kind of to slow down operations, as it were, and consumers, private consumers, at the very bottom of that list. What's the procedure in Ireland?
Yeah, I'm you know, not at total liberty to disclose that, but we do have a plan as to what we would do, you know, if we only had 80% of the gas that we need, 70%, 60%, 20%, you get the picture. And obviously what we'll prioritise, for example, is, you know, hospitals and essential public infrastructure, then essential industry. You know, we'll need to continue to manufacture food and medicines, for example. So I think to a certain extent people will know this drill from the pandemic as to what's essential and what's not. And then obviously a crucial thing then is alternative energy supplies, you know, coal, oil, for example, and always.
What's the possibility? And I appreciate you can't reveal the plans in great detail, but I mean, people still are listening to you, and they've just heard you say it's a very real possibility, not a likelihood, but a very real possibility that supply becomes constrained, and they'll wonder whether they themselves, private consumers, will have to turn off their gas.
Yeah, you know, I think you're really down to us having very little gas at all, you know, where we'd be in the position that we'd have to do that. You know, bear in mind, some countries in Central Eastern Europe are almost totally dependent on gas to heat their homes. That's not the case here in Ireland. You know, it's a mixture of gas, electricity, home heating oil, solid fuels as well, for example. So we're a little bit more diverse in our energy mix than would be Austria, for example, or some of those countries in Central Eastern Europe where they're almost entirely dependent on gas and district heating. So, you know, we are slightly insulated from this, but I don't want to downplay this as not being a serious risk that we're preparing for. It is.
I started by asking you a few minutes ago about whether you're relieved to survive a motion of no confidence, that vote of motion of no confidence yesterday. Are you personally relieved that the DPP has decided not to pursue charges against you?
Well, I am, of course, and heard the news this day last week that the DPP determined that I didn't have a case to answer in relation to the disclosure of the document. And I've always maintained the explanation that I made to the Dáil back in November 2020, and that was that I acted lawfully and in the public interest. And while I was wrong to use an informal channel in the way that I did, I certainly didn't break any law or do anything corrupt or anything self-interested. Those allegations were false, and I think that's now clear to any fair-minded person now.
Have you changed your behaviour on foot of that?
I suppose I'm just generally more careful about anything that might be perceived as a breach of procedure. So, you know, even
but you accepted it was wrong. You just said it was wrong to do what you did, and not illegal, but wrong. That's your own words. You just used them. So, surely you've changed behaviour based on that.
Well, you know, it's not that this was something that was occurring on a regular basis or even at all in terms of any parallels. This was a kind of a one-off decision. But I am absolutely more careful. You know, when somebody asks me, can they speak to me informally about something or privately about something, I always challenge that and ask, what does that exactly mean? You know, you have to be very careful about these things in politics and in public life because it's not just, you know, it's not just important to follow the procedures. You have to, I think, show that you're following them as well. And, you know, I think I am more careful in that regard. But, you know, I do want to emphasize the fact that this wasn't a classified document. It didn't go to Cabinet. You know, some of the suggestions that I breached Cabinet confidentiality or released a classified document, like, that is all totally false. You know, I had the authority as Taoiseach to disclose the document. If the Taoiseach doesn't have the authority to do so, who does? And, you know, the idea that it was even confidential, I think, is open to question as well. But I'm glad that the matter is now behind me.
Matt O'Toole is who you shared the document with, the GP, who was a member of the NAGP at the time. Have you spoken to him since last Wednesday?
I haven't spoken to him since, I think, Christmas 2020.
Really?
Yeah, well,
But it's just a lot was made, I suppose, of the fact that you were friendly, and you know, and that provided, I suppose, the access. It sounds like maybe this whole experience has soured that.
Well, you know,
or was he overstating the case a bit?
No, look, I think we both thought it appropriate that we shouldn't be in contact. You know, while there is an investigation underway, I think secondly, beyond that, those who made these false allegations obviously tried to make out that we were in closer contact than we really ever were, and I think his comments in the Sunday paper has confirmed that.
Before I let you go then, can I just mention, Joe Brawley is going to be joining me a little bit later to talk about some of the scenes of cultural celebration that were witnessed overnight in these six counties, including an effigy of Michelle O'Neill, the First Minister Sinn Féin's Michelle O'Neill, hanging by a noose from a bonfire in one area of Northern Ireland. What's your reaction when you see images like that and celebration of that culture?
I think it's appalling. I think it's unacceptable. Among the things that are done as well is the, you know, burning of, you know, election posters from different parties, Alliance, Sinn Féin, SDLP, others. I just think that's the tricolour as well on occasions, even the Palestinian flag. I just think that's wrong. I think it's absolutely right that people who are part of the orange culture in our country should be proud of that and should celebrate it. And I've had the privilege, in fact, of attending a 12th parade in Enniskillen with Peter Robinson and Arlene Foster going back years ago when relations were much better. So, you know, I respect the right of people to celebrate their culture, and orange culture is part of that. But you don't need to insult other people in the process. You know, it's not a good culture when you have to somehow, or you feel you somehow express your culture by insulting or demonising other people. I just don't understand that mentality.
Tánaiste Liathbhreacair. Tánaiste, thanks a million for joining us here on The Hard Shoulder. Lots still to come on the show today, including this Lido that's planned for Dublin. But why only Dublin? What about other parts of the country? Apparently they've got two ready to go in Limerick.
Moncrief. Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
Weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.